You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, companies involved in making and selling opioids have agreed to a $26 billion settlement over their role in the opioid epidemic. Attorney General Josh Call joins the show to talk about where that money will go and what it will be used for here in Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about how a box of old cassette tapes connected a Madison musician with his father and his heritage.
Clint Greendeer is a musician and a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. This is his story about discovering a box of old cassettes and how restoring and archiving the songs on those tapes has connected him with his heritage and his father.
Yeah, those great memories, you know, being raised in my family. It's my mom, my dad, and I'm the youngest out of five, so I'm the baby. A lot of it's like my dad just taking me to Ho-Chunk ceremonies, singing in the car to and from, learning a lot of these songs that are important to us because we're the ones who remember them and keep them going and keep passing them on. My Jaji, or my dad, Conroy Greendeer Sr., he's an amazing singer, and he knew hundreds and hundreds of songs. And my memories of him, you know, listening to other musicians and stuff, he'd still always kind of link that in with our own culture and our heritage. We would definitely be listening to some rock, like Guns N' Roses and stuff, or B.B. King, Louis Armstrong, like, my dad, he'd always kind of say, like, they all have such beautiful voices and such range. Like, imagine if they were singing all these Wungshik songs with us. Like, that'd be phenomenal. I'd be like, Dad, I don't know if, like, Louis Armstrong is really going to be at the powwow or anything like that, but... My dad passed away about 6 years ago now, I think. Yeah, we came across all of his tapes. He has a huge tape collection. It's got to have hundreds of tapes in there. It's got language tapes. It's got powwow tapes, songs for our ceremonies. A lot of my family kind of reiterated to me, like, oh, gee, you know, your dad has a lot of really important, you know, songs and teachings in all of those tapes. Like, you know, someone should really try to digitize those or something, because, you know, tapes, they can degrade and eventually, you know, they can break. And I was like, okay, well, I should take it upon myself to go through these tapes and at least get them in a digital format. And it's going to be a resource that, you know, myself and younger ones than I will be able to learn from too. Our Ho-Chunk songs, yeah, they go back ice ages ago. They're passed down to us from our ancestors, and that's why my dad, he always put a lot of importance and significance into making sure that he taught me these songs so that, you know, that we can keep these songs alive, keep them going. It's significant to us because, yeah, we're the ones that sing it. We're the ones that teach it to our younger relatives. I was kind of going through the tapes, and then I kind of came across one section where it was just my dad singing by himself, and me just hearing that, you know, it's a very, like, intimate recording of, like, just my dad, and it's, you know, I felt like he was in the room with me. When I come across tapes like those, that's where, you know, I kind of get a, you know, a chill up my spine, because it's, that's a certain kind of energy and certain kind of moments that, you know, I've personally haven't been around because I was so young. I hear those tapes and I'm like, oh yeah, this is why I'm doing this. These are the moments that I love to document. Those kind of moments are great to revisit because it comes to show, you know, he's really not that far away. It's a bit of a tedious and daunting task, but I don't know. It feels good to try to keep those moments, those recordings alive. At least so they can play one last time for me to record it. That's all I need the tape to do. I just need you to get through that one more time playing. My experience with music, it was a different pathway that my dad took. I mean, the path I took was more playing guitar in a band. It's kind of interesting to listen to moments and tracks that, you know, he recorded in his like 20s or getting towards his 30s, and that's like my age now. And it's great to kind of listen to things that he was making at my age. That's such a cool little time capsule for me. It's been cool that I'm able to learn from my dad and still add a little bit of what I've learned through my life, my experience, and being able to make that connection into something completely new. Could I do a send-off in Ho-Chunk? Shigay honey chuck chowie. See you again.
Clint Greendeer is a musician and a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Original guitar music, including this song, is by Clint Greendeer. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we'll talk to Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call about the hundreds of millions of dollars coming to Wisconsin as part of a settlement from opioid drug lawsuits. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, drug makers and distributors have agreed to pay $26 billion to settle claims alleging they contributed to the opioid epidemic. Under that agreement, Wisconsin will receive more than $400 million of that funding. So how will that money be divided up across the state? How will it be used to deal with Wisconsin's opioid crisis? Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins us now. Attorney General Call, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
$400 million coming from this settlement for Wisconsin. How does that get divided up?
Yeah, this money is going to transform our response to the opioid epidemic, and it's the result of years of investigation and, in some cases, litigation. Under state law, 70% of the money that Wisconsin receives is going to go to county and local governments that were involved in litigation over the opioid epidemic. The other 30% is going to go to our State Department of Health Services, and those funds need to be used to support efforts to fight the opioid epidemic. And how exactly they get allocated is going to be decided by those county and local governments and by the Department of Health Services.
For the state part of this, what's the plan for using this money to help combat the opioid epidemic?
The Department of Health Services will ultimately decide where those funds go, and I know that they're in the process right now of engaging in listening sessions. My hope is to see those funds, though, go towards long-term investments that can help us ultimately beat this epidemic, including funding things like treatment programs, prevention programs, and recovery programs.
looking at the bigger picture of this settlement. This comes from Johnson & Johnson for their production and marketing of opioids, and three really big companies that aren't household names that distribute it. They're the ones that pharmacies, for example, buy from. Can you talk about why the state was involved in this lawsuit, what you hoped to get out of it?
One of my priorities as Attorney General has been to strengthen our response to the opioid epidemic. And as part of that effort, we've been making sure we're taking a hard line when it comes to holding Big Pharma accountable for its role in this epidemic. We sued Purdue Pharma in my first year in office, and we also joined multi-state investigations into these three distributors. And one of the things we allege in the complaint we filed against Purdue Pharma is that the opioid epidemic didn't need to happen. It happened for a variety of reasons, but including that pharmaceutical companies engaged in false and deceptive marketing practices, or in some cases looked the other way when there were prescriptions that they had to have known couldn't have been legitimate. Holding those companies accountable is important to make sure that this never happens again. But it's also important because it brings resources to the state of Wisconsin that can go towards these efforts to fight the epidemic. And now we're seeing the results of that with this more than $400 million that's going to be coming to the state.
As I understand it, none of the companies in this settlement admitted to wrongdoing as part of the settlement. Do you wish that you had held out for that, you and the many other entities involved in this lawsuit had held out for that?
Well, you always want to see people acknowledge their responsibility for any conduct that violates the law. But we didn't want to let those sorts of issues stop us from bringing dollars to our communities that can help fight the opioid epidemic now. As a result of this resolution, there's going to be about $50 million coming to Wisconsin this year, and then an additional $350 million plus over a number of years going forward. And it's also important to note that this isn't the only matter involving opioid distributors or manufacturers. We are in bankruptcy proceedings involving Purdue Pharma, for example, and there could be other cases as well. And our goal is to get as many dollars to our communities in the state as we can to help people with the fight against the opioid epidemic.
Unfortunately, by a lot of measures, the opioid epidemic in the U.S. has gotten worse over the last couple of years. What do you see as the biggest areas of concern right now?
There are two things that I think are really driving the spike that we have seen. One is the pandemic has strained all sorts of resources and ties between people, and that's had a number of different negative effects on people's health and on both their mental health and their physical health. And it's also led to, I think, an increase in substance use disorder. So partly we need to make sure we're investing in treatment and recovery programs that can help people who are struggling with substance use disorder. The other thing we've seen is a lot of fentanyl being sold illegally. Fentanyl is an incredibly potent opioid. It's far more dangerous than even heroin and other opioids. And it often gets mixed in with other drugs without people knowing. And it's really critical that people are aware of the dangers of ingesting fentanyl, and that they're aware that they may not even know that they're taking fentanyl and it can lead to overdose deaths. So the more that we can do to prevent all types of substance use disorder, the more that we're going to be able to reduce opioid-related overdose deaths.
What efforts are underway to try to stop the flow of fentanyl into Wisconsin?
I think there are a few things. One is we need to try to reduce the demand for all different types of drugs, and that means engaging in treatment and diversion efforts, like I've been talking about, and also prevention efforts to make clear to people before they become addicted the dangers of becoming addicted to any kind of narcotic. But also we need to make sure that there's a strong enforcement effort. Partly that means discouraging overprescription so people don't become addicted to opioids and then ultimately turn to illegal opioids, and there's been some real success on that front. But it also means making sure that we are engaging in long-term intensive investigations into drug trafficking networks so that those who are bringing these drugs into Wisconsin and other states are investigated and ultimately prosecuted and put behind bars.
On the initial problem of overprescription of opioids, do you think we're doing better now than we were at the outset of this latest surge in opioid use?
I think we are doing better when it comes to the prescription front. The number of opioids that are prescribed is still far above where it was a little over 20 years ago. But it's also decreased pretty significantly over the last several years. And there are a number of steps that we've taken both in Wisconsin and nationally that have helped that, including things like the prescription drug monitoring program, which helps, among other things, prevent people from going to multiple doctors. I think the message has also gotten out that there had been overprescription, and that's caused some prescribers to rethink their practices in a way that's been helpful. And we've made sure that people are aware that there's a danger to opioid use, even if it's from a prescription. So we're making progress there, but we've also got to make sure that for people who are addicted, that they have access to treatment programs and recovery programs, so they're not left to potentially turn to illegal opioids like heroin or fentanyl, but instead are able to get the help that they need to address their addiction.
For those kind of treatment and recovery programs, we hear there's a pressing need for them. This settlement we're talking about, is this enough money to put even a dent in our needs here?
Yeah, I think that this will make a significant difference in our response. It's not going to be all the resources that we need to fight the opioid epidemic, and it certainly doesn't match the harm and the devastation that the opioid epidemic has caused. But, you know, to put this in perspective, you know, the $50 million coming to the state of Wisconsin this year far exceeds the amount that we spend annually on the treatment alternatives and diversion program, which helps people who end up in the criminal justice system get access to treatment. So this will really reinforce our efforts, but it can't be the only thing we're doing. We need to continue investing in fighting this epidemic because it continues to be devastating to people across the state and across the country.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is with us for a look at this new opioid drug settlement. A lot of money coming into Wisconsin. And I want to turn Attorney General Call to a couple other legal issues related to Wisconsin. We've got the state Supreme Court ruling on the state's redistricting plan, going with the latest effort from Governor Evers to meet their standard of least changes. Now Republican lawmakers going to the U.S. Supreme Court, looking to turn it back to their initial plan. Is the State Department of Justice going to be involved in that if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, we will. I've been representing Governor Evers, as have some of my colleagues. You know, the original ruling from the State Supreme Court that it was going to minimize changes to the current maps was one we had argued against. We thought that there should be a fair map process so that we have truly nonpartisan maps. But Governor Evers then submitted the maps that best met the test that the state Supreme Court had set, which was to minimize changes. And in doing so, he also submitted maps that are fairer. They're still not neutral, but they're fairer than the prior maps. And they best met the criteria that the state Supreme Court had set. I'm confident that those maps are going to remain in place as the appeal process plays out. And we will continue to be engaged in that litigation on behalf representing Governor Evers and ultimately to serve the best interests of Wisconsinites.
If this goes before the U.S. Supreme Court, what argument would you make that they should stay with the maps that the state Supreme Court went with?
Well, usually the federal courts defer to the state court judgments and state practices when states set maps. You know, we will see exactly what arguments are raised here. But so far, the U.S. Supreme Court has been reluctant this year to get involved in maps that have been put in place in other states. There have been several places now where the U.S. Supreme Court has said that we're too close to the election to get involved. I expect that we're going to see something similar here. But also the maps that were adopted in Wisconsin comply with all the applicable laws. And, you know, the state Supreme Court used the standard it had set, and Governor Evers' maps best met that standard, so I expect that they'll remain in place.
You mentioned the time consideration here. The clock is ticking. April 15th, candidates start circulating nomination papers for elections later this year. If the U.S. Supreme Court did flip the decision from the state Supreme Court here, is there time to change the maps in, what, just over a month?
I don't think there is because, you know, first, the State Election Commission had asked to have maps in place by the beginning of this month. The state Supreme Court wasn't quite able to do that, but it was very close, and there is time now to get everything set. But if the U.S. Supreme Court weighs in here, they would be invalidating the map, and we'd have to go through a new map drawing process, and that would make the whole process, it would really require a restart of the whole process. So I don't, for that reason, as well as some of the other reasons we talked about, I don't expect that to happen, and I'm confident that it won't.
and former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman released his second interim report last week in his ongoing investigation chartered by the state assembly leader looking into the 2020 elections. Do you have response to his calls to get rid of the Wisconsin Election Commission or his urging of lawmakers to take a look at the idea of somehow decertifying the outcome of that election?
The Voss Gabelman investigation is an embarrassment to our state. It is a waste of tax dollars. It has embraced conspiracy theories that have already been addressed and rejected. And he's also bought into what are really fringe legal theories, including the theory that the state legislature, the politicians, can overturn the democratic results of an election, even if they've been certified by a court. I mean, that's really extreme and anti-democratic. I think that the Voss Gabelman investigation shouldn't be given any consideration. And it's telling, I think, that even Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin aren't coming back into session to act on Justice Gabelman's report. Instead, they are going home for the year. So I don't think that that report has been given really any credibility by even Republican legislators. And I think people should just ignore it.
Attorney General Call, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Attorney General Josh Call with us today to talk about how Wisconsin will distribute its share of the new $26 billion opioid drug settlement, plus a look at a couple of election-related issues here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, some schools are turning to private sponsorships or naming rights to help meet their budget needs. We'll find out what's going on, what's legal and what isn't, and you could share your thoughts on the idea. You can get started right now. Is this something you're seeing in your own community? Is the stadium, say, at the high school, does it have the name of a local business on it? Let us know. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Also tomorrow, a UW Oshkosh class has a unique project trying to solve cold cases here in Wisconsin. Find out what they've accomplished so far and what's in the works. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we look at political trends in rural parts of Wisconsin with a move toward Republicans in recent elections and what it all means for this year's midterms. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to a former Energy Department employee about the U.S. ban of Russian oil and gas imports and the role of energy resources in national security. First, rural areas and small towns in Wisconsin have been trending more conservative and more Republican. For example, hundreds of smaller communities went for Barack Obama in his two election campaigns and went for Trump in 2016 and 2020. That's not just Wisconsin. States around the country are seeing similar trends in rural communities. So what's going on? How do we account for this ideological divide between more rural and urban parts of the state? How are the Democrats and the Republicans responding? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you listening from a rural part of the state? What do you see going on near you? Do you talk about politics in your neck of the woods, or is it a difficult conversation to have? Do you feel like things are divided or united on one side or the other? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anthony Chergosky is an assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse. His specialties include American and Wisconsin political campaigns and elections, political communication, and mass media. Anthony, welcome back to Central Time. Do we have Anthony? We will reconnect with Anthony, it looks like. In the meantime, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think there's a big divide between rural and urban communities, a growing partisan divide based in part on geography? If you live in a rural part of the state, what do you want to hear from either party or both parties? What do you think they're missing about your community? Do they pay attention to you at all? Call 800-642-1234. Anthony Chergosky is with us now. Anthony, welcome back to the show. Okay, I think we got you now, Anthony. Hi.
All there right. we are. Nice okay. to be with you, Rob.
That last one was on our end, I know. Now, Wisconsin not alone in this trend. Rural voters turning more toward Republicans, conservatives. Big picture, what are we seeing with trends in Wisconsin around the country?
Well, Rob, I think you make an important observation that the rural-urban political divide is not unique to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We've seen this widening gap all around the country where Republicans are gaining ground in rural areas, Democrats are continuing to build their support in urban areas. But there is a unique aspect of Wisconsin in this urban-rural divide. And Rob, it's simply put that Wisconsin has a more intense urban-rural political divide than most other states. The urban-rural divide is particularly pronounced in Wisconsin. The urban-rural divide has widened before it widened in other states, and it really structures politics in Wisconsin to an extent that it doesn't in other states. So, sure, the urban-rural divide is present in all states, and urban-rural politics have always been an issue in the United States, but here in Wisconsin, it is particularly strong, and I would say, Rob, that it is a defining feature of Wisconsin politics, the urban-rural political divide.
Okay, why Wisconsin?
Well, a couple reasons, Rob. First, Wisconsin politicians have been particularly aggressive in exploiting the urban-rural divide. We've seen politicians in their campaigns and in their rhetoric try to pit urban areas against rural areas for the purposes of winning elections. Some of this has come in the form of saying, hey, this other party has forgotten about you in this geographic area, or we're going to serve your area unlike the other party. So what has happened, Rob, is that the geographic divide in Wisconsin now overlaps almost perfectly with the partisan divide. And when you have two very strong divides overlapping like that, the incredible partisan divide and the incredible geographic divide, when you have two very stark lines of division overlapping, that is a recipe for some serious conflict.
A couple of articles lately have looked at this, not just in terms of the vote counts, though that's a big part of the story, but about life in rural communities for the few remaining Democrats there feeling like nervous about expressing their political views publicly, feeling ostracized in their communities. It's not just the voting, it's that the Democratic brand is seen as an outside force in some ways in a lot of communities. You tweeted about that. What do you make of things at that level beyond what the final vote tallies are?
Rob, this really reflects the extent to which the urban-rural divide is about identity politics. By that, I mean how political party has become baked into people's identity. So when we hear about the intense partisan conflict in rural areas, how people are hostile and how there are uncomfortable conversations, that does not just reflect a policy divide between the parties. It reflects a more fundamental identity divide where political party has become so important to people, it is now part of their identity. There is strong evidence in political science to show this, that it's one thing to say that I align with the Republican Party or I align with the Democratic Party. But now what we're seeing is people saying, I am a Democrat. I am a Republican. It's part of their identity, just as their geographic area has become part of their identity. Whether they're a rural resident or an urban resident, that has become baked into their identity. So the reason this conflict is particularly vicious, in my view, is that it's not just a policy battle. This is about people's sense of identity. This is about people's sense of who they are. And that leads to some really uncomfortable situations, some real political hostility.
Talking to Anthony Trigosky, assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse, looking at the political divide, the urban-rural divide, especially in Wisconsin, and focusing on rural Wisconsin in particular, moving conservative, moving Republican. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lots of callers. Let's bring them on. Eric is with us in the Village of Endeavor. Eric, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I live in rural Wisconsin, and I'm surrounded by Trump signs and Trump 2020 everything. My next door neighbor's had his flag at half mast since November 3rd, 2020. He has got hand painted Biden sucks signs, and and he's still adding bumper stickers to his truck. It's kind of interesting.
Eric, you referring to other people as Trump supporters? Do you fit in there? Do you feel like, are you on one side or the other? How does that all affect you?
Well, I was a registered Republican most of my life, but a few years ago, I started looking into things a little more. And let's say I didn't vote for Biden, but I did vote against Trump. So, yeah, I voted for Biden.
Eric, thanks for the call. Thanks for sharing your story there. Anthony, Eric pointing toward not just everybody around him is a Republican or Trump supporter, but very vocal and visual about it.
And Rob, that is exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about identity politics. You know, people wouldn't be so vocal about their political points of view if they tended to support one party or another just because they kind of agreed with one party's policy stances or they kind of aligned with one party's ideology a little more than another. But now, which candidate people support is a fundamental feature of who they consider themselves to be as a person, and which political party they support is a fundamental feature of who they consider themselves to be as a person. And we see this in rural areas, especially where people are identifying themselves as rural residents, that is a part of who they think they are, and that their political party affiliation is a part of who they think they are. That's the same thing going on in urban areas, but to the caller's point, it can make things uncomfortable for those who don't quite fit in with the crowd in these geographic areas.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Bella now in Racine. Bella, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Bella?
Well, my comment is that I am total agreement with what is being said, and I'm in Racine. It's a mixed bag, and I think that our formerly twice disgraced leader in charge gaslit what a lot of people are feeling in various places as they see times change. More people of color are moving into suburbs and rural areas, and now all of a sudden there's a fear. There's nowhere to run. There's nowhere to hide. And you don't know who your neighbor's going to be. In addition to the complicated factors of these areas, I lived over near Dodgeville. These areas have very limited news sources, TV, cable and stuff. One, you can only get one or two. The phones go in and out. You don't have even kids that can be homeschooled or get virtual lessons. So people don't have all the information, and these areas are saturated. When we look at one or two places in the United States where we have owners who have bought up all the news channels around these places, Vermont, Wisconsin, all over the place, to keep people in the dark about what's going on.
Bella, thanks a lot for that call. A couple of big points Bella's making there. First, concern maybe in rural communities about change, unwelcome change, and news deserts almost.
Rob, I think those are extremely important points. There is good evidence in political science that when local news declines, people lean into their political party identity. People become more intense in their partisanship. And I think that's exactly what you're seeing around the country. And it is a great concern to see the decline of local news because it feeds into the partisan conflict. It makes people double and triple down on their political party affiliation. To the caller's other point, I think she makes a very important observation. The Democrats want to try to cut into the rural deficit they have by focusing on bread and butter issues like rural broadband and agriculture. And as Tony Evers mentioned in his State of the State, more funding for rural emergency services. But what if this isn't really about bread and butter economic issues? What if this is really more about the culture wars and identity politics and the anxieties associated with a changing America? If that's the case, then I'm not sure the Democrats really have a great answer for what's happening in rural areas. They can certainly try to appeal to rural areas with economic benefits and trying to speak to the economic needs of rural areas. But if that's not what this conflict is actually about, then the Democrats may find their efforts to be unsuccessful.
Bella, thanks for the call. We're talking to Anthony Trigosky, assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse, looking at why rural and small towns in Wisconsin have been voting more and more for Republican candidates over the years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about your community? Are you in touch with the local political scene where you live? Do people talk about politics, debate politics, or issues? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We pick up our conversation now with Anthony Trigosky from UW La Crosse, political scientist there, looking at the divide in voting and political partisanship in Wisconsin, urban versus rural, focusing mostly on rural Wisconsin now, and a long-term move toward conservative and Republican voting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, you interviewed Anthony, Lieutenant Governor and U.S. Senate candidate Mandela Barnes on La Crosse Talk Radio WIZM some weeks back about this very topic. Here's a little of what he had to say.
Some rural parts of the state, we may never win back, but if we're able to show up, leading with our values, leading with our vision, making the direct connection with people about those bread and butter issues, those kitchen table issues, if we can take a 60-40 margin to 55-45, then we're well on our way to where we need to be as a party. But it takes some real intentionality for that to happen. You know, we can't just assume that these areas won't vote for us, and we can't just also show up acting like we know everything, because that's not the case at all, and that's the quickest way to lose a vote.
So the case there, hey, maybe Democrats can't win in these rural areas, but they could maybe tip scales closer. Do you have to show up to win, whether you're a Democrat in a rural area or a Republican going to a big city?
I think so, Rob. And I think Mandela Barnes has quite a realistic perspective about the prospects for Democrats in rural areas. The urban-rural divide has become quickly entrenched as a fundamental feature of Wisconsin politics. So the idea that the Democrats can completely flip the urban-rural divide and gain significant ground in rural areas is unrealistic. But if they can move the margins a little bit in their favor in rural areas, then that could be enormously advantageous for them, especially because Democrats are now running up enormous margins in the booming Dane County and Madison area. Plus, they consistently drive up big margins in Milwaukee. So if they can move the margins just a little bit more in their favor in rural areas, then that could bode quite well for Democrats in rural areas. So I think Mandela Barnes viewed it from a realistic perspective about what is and what is not possible for Democrats at this point, given the entrenched nature of the urban-rural divide.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jeff is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. So the professor was talking about the parties politicizing the urban and rural divide. And the first thing that came to mind for me was the Republican state legislature hamstringing Milwaukee city services, especially Milwaukee public schools. My question, and I'm genuinely asking, I'm not trying to argue, is what would be the comparable example for like urban Democrats trying to affect or interfere with maybe a way of life for rural Republicans?
Anthony?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think we have to be honest about how Republicans have exploited the urban-rural divide. You see Republicans talk about urban areas in a way that Democrats don't really talk about rural areas. You hear Republicans talk about the values and the way things are done in urban areas. Recently, Senator Ron Johnson made a joking remark about how, you know, maybe they'll find just enough votes in Milwaukee to have him lose his reelection battle. And so Republicans are often dismissive of urban areas. I think when you look at the challenges that both parties have, the Republicans have been quite, overlooking urban areas because they have really doubled and tripled down on their rural base and have not felt the need to really appeal to urban areas. But Rob, that could be a real problem for Republicans because the population of rural areas is declining. So Republicans might be able to squeeze some more votes out of rural areas in the short term. Frankly, I don't think the Democrats have quite even hit bottom yet in rural areas. I think the situation is so dire for Democrats in rural areas that they could still lose some more votes. But if these are not growth areas, and they're not, the population of rural Wisconsin is declining, young people are leaving and they're not coming back, these are aging communities, so it's not really a long-term viable strategy for Republicans to double and triple down on rural areas. I think they can get by with that in the short term, but I don't know that it's a long-term strategy. And as far as the challenges that Democrats face, as we've talked about, you know, Democrats are approaching this from a bread and butter issues perspective, kind of thinking that they can appeal to the economic interests of rural areas, but that might not be what this urban-rural divide is about at all. And so Democrats might have the wrong diagnosis for their problems in rural areas.
We heard it from a bunch of people on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David writes, maybe the rural population is statistically older. Older people tend to be more conservative. Is that part of the demographic story here, Anthony?
It certainly is. And that's why I think Republicans do have reason to be concerned about their reliance on their rural base, because rural Wisconsin is aging. There are real issues economically in rural areas. In my view, efforts to reverse rural economic and demographic decline have been at best scattershot and at worst just non-existent. So it does have to do with the demographics of these areas. But at the same time, there's no doubt that the urban-rural divide has increased, that Republicans have increased their votes in rural Wisconsin, Democrats have increased their votes in urban Wisconsin. Like we talked about, Rob, now the geographic divide in Wisconsin really overlaps quite neatly with the partisan divide to an extent that wasn't true before. But certainly, you do need to account for the demographics in each of these geographic regions.
Time for one more caller. Jim is with us in Janesville. Jim, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I just wondered if the professor wasn't possibly hitting on a point that he didn't mean to. I think a lot of rural people, including older people and Hispanic people, feel like Democrats talk down to them, like we're the rural, and I think that that's possibly a part of the reason that they're becoming more conservative. And also, what about the Hispanic population in general possibly becoming more conservative? Is that part of the equation as well?
Jim, we don't have thanks for that call. We don't have too much time left, Anthony. That second part, I think, is worth a whole nother conversation. But that idea that rural communities may feel talked down to by Democrats, I know there are some rural Democrats very worried about exactly what Jim brought up there, Anthony.
I think Jim is spot on. I do think that Democrats have a risk of coming across as condescending to rural areas. I do think Democrats need to refigure how they will communicate with rural areas, and they need to have a better understanding of why they are losing ground in rural areas. So I think the caller is absolutely correct.
Jim, thanks for calling in. And Anthony, thanks for joining us again. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Anthony Chergosky, assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. We talked to him today about the growth of Republican support in rural areas and small towns in Wisconsin, how the parties are responding to changes in population growth and voter support. There's still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe what you're seeing in your own community, especially if you are in a small town or rural part of the state. Especially love to hear from you on this, because we're talking about you. You can let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, a former Energy Department official explains the U.S. ban on Russian oil and gas, how it fits into national security, climate change, energy security, and the prices we pay at the pump. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.